Good morning, good morning. Good morning, honorable members. Good morning, Umnomzana, Umkhaliphi. You seem to be alone today. Oh, and the team, the Palestinian was. Our friend from the PLO, state law advisors, the legal team. Good morning. I had a meeting this morning with the with the ANC team. That's why I came in a little bit late to this meeting here, just about the changes that we made to the documents last week. The referencing that in my organization we consult on everything. It's called public participation. It's called joint decision making. We don't use consultants. We don't use consultants on matters like that. Honorable members, today is Tuesday, 23rd, and we are continuing with the deliberations on the Labor Relations Amendment Bill. There is not going to be any, some moody reminding us of what we discussed last week. It's still fresh in our minds. So I'll give over to Khalipi so that we push. Advocate Gordon is going to leave us a little bit earlier because she has something to do with the committee work, the legal matters related to to our work as a committee. So I'm asking that we release at that time whenever she wants to leave. So, Umnomzana Umkhaliphi, you and your team are in your hands. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, honorable members. We went up to clause 24 last week, amendment of section 149. We're starting now clause 25. From amendment of section 147. This is a section that excludes MPs from abolishing the CCMA because they're earning too much. This is a section where the restriction to the CCMA is introduced for those who are earning four times the threshold. No, making a mistake. Oh, sorry, I'm making a big mistake. That's not fair. This is a section that allowed the CCMA to assume jurisdiction, that means the term that lawyers understand, to assume jurisdiction in all cases. Remember, the LRA has privatized dispute resolution. You've got the CCMA, you've got the bargaining council that deals with dispute resolution, that's clause 24, section 147. You've got also private agreements between companies and individuals on how to deal with disputes. And in many cases, those private agreements refer to arbitration. Now, this clause mainly says that if the employee earns less than the threshold, that's the first thing, this threshold keeps on coming, you must put in your head this threshold in all of our legislation keeps on coming. If the employee earns less than the threshold, which is presently now 172, the CCMA must assume responsibility in all the cases. Therefore, the CCMA must be able to say, even if you got an agreement with your employer that says your dispute will be handled this way through arbitration, the CCMA is entitled by law to say, no, you don't go through that process. We will hear your case. And the conditions are two. The two conditions of the CCMA will say that. The first one is, if that employee who's earning less than the threshold is required to pay, for example, private arbitration, in many cases, parties pay 50-50. Now, this is trying to protect employees who are earning less than threshold, who might not have the money to pay for arbitration. Therefore, they might opt not to take their case, not because they don't have the case, but because they don't have the money to pay for the arbitration. Now, that's what this is trying to protect. Trying to protect those employees who are earning less than the threshold, who've got contracts of employment that they signed, that says their dispute will be referred to private arbitration, for example. And it's trying to make sure that access to justice is not denied because people cannot afford. That's the first thing this is saying. The second situation where the CCMA would assume responsibility is if, by any chance, the target arbitrator that is appointed or the institution that is dealing with the arbitration or the dispute resolution is found not to be independent of any of the parties, and the employee says this arbitrator is not independent, or this institution that is in the ground of is not independent, there's a perception of bias, or any of the parties, then the CCMA will have authority to assume jurisdiction in those cases. That's what 47 does. We think it's a good amendment because it protects the vulnerable. I'll take if there are any questions for that. Questions for clarification.
Raise it, honourable members. Honourable Mdau.
Thanks, Chair. Just for clarity, the threshold, as we say, it's about 172. This is a moving target. It can be set at regular intervals.
The threshold is set in terms of the BCA by the Minister of Labour, and this threshold even governed the level at which UIF payments are paid, and it goes up on a year basis. The Minister will publish on a year basis to factor inflation in it. Therefore, it's not a set threshold. It's set for that period that the Minister has set up. But following year, I'm sure it will go up because inflation goes up. The Minister will publish a new threshold, and that's how it works.
Okay.
Now, the next clause will be clause 26. And then I must, as I've indicated in the other clauses, clause 25 also is one of those clauses where there's been agreement by all parties at net length. There's no disagreement in this area. Clause 26 deals with what we term in the law presently disputes of public interest. The law presently allows the CCMA, if you look at section 150 of the LRA presently, it allows the CCMA to go to parties. Either the strike that is taking place, for example, the strike, the relevant one, this strike on transport, the road front, they went through concession, they deadlocked, they issued notice, they went out on strike. CCMA issued 150, section 150 notices saying, yes, you can go out on strike, but we want to continue keep talking with you to solve this strike. Come, let's talk. Now, section 150 allows the CCMA to call parties to negotiation if there's no agreement, if the strike is likely to affect public interest. It could be a strike in ESCOM, it could be a strike anywhere where there's public interest. Even if the CCMA was not involved initially, this section says, even if it was done by public, in the public sector, for example, and it was handled by the bargaining council there, the CCMA was not involved, this section give CCMA authority to call parties. It's in the law. The law allows it. The only changes that we're making in this section now, it's only two, one change basically. Presently, parties can refuse. If CCMA says, come, just talk, they can say no. Because no, most of the time is that when the strike starts, Honorable Kamere will understand this. When the strike starts, in the first 2-3 days, the union believes that they've got all the power. When the CCMA says, come, let's talk, they say, no, we're not prepared to talk. The unit, workers are out on strike, they believe that the employer is going to crumble tomorrow. They say, no, that's the experience I've got. They refuse to talk because they believe that the employer is going to crash. Now, when a week ends, workers won't add salary, the strike is crumbling, they are prepared to come and talk. But the employer feels that the strike is crumbling, this strike is going to fall anytime. The employer refuses. That's the present situation. Now, when the system calls on parties, parties can say no. So the system can't force them. It requires them to come and talk. Parties are entitled to say no, we're not ready for that, for whatever reason. Now, the changes that we're making here in this section is that we're saying that no party can refuse. If the system says this is a dispute of public interest, we want you to talk, all parties must agree. That's the change that we're making here. All parties have agreed to this proposal except two issues. Business is of the view that you must understand presently this action does not stop the strike. Parties are entitled to continue to do what they are doing. What Cicely does said, no, let's come and talk. This is exactly what they did with the road strike. They called them on, they were still out on strike. Among Capazella were also there, try and resolve the issue. And they managed to resolve it. It did not stop the fire. Employers are saying, no. If the CCMA calls us, it's a strike of public interest, then the strike must be suspended for that period. That has not been agreed. That's what been put. But presently, this is presently the law that the strike doesn't have to stop. Because our say is that my colleagues on my left, when you say strike will stop, my saying is unconstitutional because the right to strike is a constitutional right. When we start interfering with that right, but that was not agreed. The other small issue that was raised by Spedusa has a problem with the powers that are given to the director, because the director of the CCNA, they had a problem with the director. They wanted to create the commission. It's not here nor there for us. I mean, when you say the commission, you're saying the director, because the director must execute that action. She has the commission, therefore it doesn't matter which way it is. But that's what it's saying. I'm raising this issue so that you, and I think in their input also they raised it in Parliament. I think the federal one is really a non-issue. The one that divides parties, the parties feel strong about, is whether this should have the effect of suspending the strike. The amendment does not have that. I'm raising it because it was very business. And as I've explained that, if something is not accepted by government, it does not go into the bill. Because the bill is, even at NERLEC accepted, the bill is a government document. But we indicate the areas that there's been a disagreement on the issues and what parties are saying. And that's the issue there. Business accepts the proposal as it is. They don't have a problem with the principle of parties not having to refuse CCMA. They don't have a problem. Labour doesn't have a problem with that. All of us agree, except that, as I've said, people would have felt that we should be referring to the commission, then the director. As I said, it's not here and there for us. You should be, all business also felt that this should be able to suspend the strike in the meantime. And that's not what the law says presently.
Okay, clarification. Thank you, Mr. Honorable Van der Westhuizen, Honorable Khanare, Honorable Mutau. Thank you, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Here I'm looking towards the legal experts here with us to just give us some guidance regarding the FIDUSA proposal, as Mr. Mkalipi has raised it quite correctly. I've also made a mark here whether there would be any improvement in the wording if we replace the word director with the word the commission. Is it the commission that appoint one or two commissioners, or is the director that appoint one or two commissioners? I presume that if the director herself is not available, then there would be an acting director, and therefore that there will not be a gap if the word director remains. But I think it's a technical issue. I think it's a legal issue on which we would love to get clarity. As Mr. Mkalipi said, I think it's a matter of wording, which we obviously just would like to get the safest option, so that this doesn't get challenged in court or somewhere else. Thank you.
And thanks and welcome, Mr. Vanderbilt, the Honourable. Yeah, Mkalipi, if you can. I'm Honourable Khanal.
I was going to ask the similar question, but in addition to that, you see, the way we are approaching this, we are approaching it as there will always be two parties. The unions will be involved, the employers will be involved. But recently we have seen that there might be a fine which will affect public interest, but where you find it very difficult to interact with whoever we have got to interact with. I mean, the examples of the miners' strike, that a similar situation might arise. But I wanted to check whether we have thought about the consequences of people who are not cooperating. I know they are not protected, it's not a protected strike. But there must be, if we can identify that there is a particular union which then hides itself because they want something to happen, but they don't want to take responsibility. They don't want to be said, they don't want it to be said that this union is the one in charge. But they then say, they do everything else except accepting the responsibility for that. And that there are going to be consequences of that. My own view is that if your union is disruptive of the industrial relations regime, if there is a need, I know I'm extreme. If there is a need for you to be registered, because you don't want to fall within the game, the rules of the game.
Some action to be taken.
I don't know whether
you can
capture my
view.
Honourable
Madam. Thank you, Chair. Chair, just a quick one for clarification. I think it makes sense that the CCMA should be able to, call the parties in dispute to come in, and there's no discretion as to whether they may or may not come. They are obliged to come. My question is, what remedy is there for the CCMA if they don't come or they still refuse to come?
Thank you, and welcome Honorable Lyon to the meeting.
My learned friends will respond on the first question on what I can, in assistance to this, inform the members that the present section 150 talks to the commission, the present in the law, that's what's in the law, talks to the commission. It talks about the commission. But as I said, from our side of the department, it's not here nor there. The commission is just like is embodied in the director. The director has to institute whatever function are given to the commission. We don't think there's any legal effect on this, but the guys from the lawyers, I'm a Bush lawyer, the qualified lawyers can give a credible answer. Now, on the question that are asked by Honorable Khanara and Honorable Mudawi are similar on the consequences of not accepting the court, and the one from Honorable Khanara, the one saying that what happens if there's no official trade union per se, it could be a group of workers, it could be a union that does not take responsibility. Actually, the way the section is crafted, it talks to parties. And a party could be anybody. It could be, if the system is believed that your organization, whether you believe or not, you accept that or not, your organization is central in solving that dispute, the system is able to call on you to come here. It does not have to be confined to trade unions or employer organizations. The parties who are involved, it could be a group of workers, as I said, it could be even unregistered trade unions, it could be or trade unions themselves. Yes, it could be socialist emergency. Now, the question asked by Honorable Zhao is, what are the consequences of if the party now does not heed the call? The first thing is that the Labor Relations Act is a product of consensus. And strike is about public support also. We put our hope on the basis that no party in strike would want to lose the public discord. If there's a semi call on parties to come and resolve the dispute and one party refused, and the CCMA made that statement and said that in terms of Section 150, we have called on the parties to come and discuss the issue, one party has refused, it's not good for that party even during strike action. That's the first thing. That's where we're coming from, the department there. This thing also that the CCMA can go to the labor court if the other party does not want to come into the party and ask the labor court to compel them in terms of the powers of the labor court, because the law says that they should not refuse on this issue, they can do that. And we have not linked this up with any other preventive measures other than those. We think that public pressure is going to play a very big part. We think that the commitment of the parties to the law itself would play a big part. And we don't have many of those strikes where, I mean, this issue of the mining trade is an exception. I mean, it's not the norm. I mean, if you look since 1995, the industrial action that has taken place, there have always been organizations that take responsibility for that. And we don't think that it seems the least of our problems if we solve this problem. This is the first time where you had a situation where you're not sure who are the parties, whether AMCU is responsible. Initially, we all thought AMCU was responsible. I'm not sure by now whether they've got that power to tell the workers whether to come to work or not. I don't think so. It's a unique situation, the one that's taking place there. I think it has got to be dealt uniquely using creativity of the parties. And we see that the CCMA has succeeded in bringing the parties there to the table to talk. Whether it has succeeded to solve the problem, that's a longer-term issue, but bringing them in for discussion, it is exactly the using that section of 50 there. And then that's the view that we're putting on this. And we have not linked it to all of the other processes of deregistration, registration, and all those issues. We're seeing that public pressure will force parties to come on the table when they are called on.
And there was a suggestion by Honorable Van der Westhuizen about an addition or something. Will it change that? I think I might have missed that. Maybe if you in your further responses, if you could touch that too, I think it may be helpful to me and to other members.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. just 3 points. The first one is, it's in the nature of the LRA. The LRA, it's a blunt instrument because it relies entirely on the willingness of the parties to engage. It is possible that a commissioner may seek a labor court order to force the other party to come to the table. But that does not give you the guarantee that when they do arrive at the table, they will open their mouth. They can come and just keep quiet. And this is precisely what happened in the road freight dispute. Parties came in, they kept quiet. and Kira Chivedi was the facilitator. They kept quiet in the meeting. Nobody wanted to say a thing. He had to be extremely creative in getting them to start talking. So to spend the whole day just sitting in the boardroom and saying nothing. So it's the nature of the beast that there are instances where you may not be successful in being punitive if parties don't tell the lie. But what is useful is to have a recourse in the event that they become less cooperative. But forcing them really, it's an option that is just not there. It's an option that you may seek to exercise, but it may not deliver the goods. So it's in the nature of the thing. It assumes that people want to talk, because it's in the nature of South Africans that we talk, we resolve our problems by talking. But it doesn't guarantee that people would really come in and do so. I think the wording of our director, as we said, is neither here nor there. I mean, when the final bow is fine-tuned, I mean, that can factor in. It's not an issue that we will have difficulties with. Now, the point for me is, what happens if the other party, if there are parties that hide in the bigger scheme of things, in the chaos of the strike action? Unfortunately, that's precisely what solidarity means, is that there will be a lot of parties, and some would actually use the strike for their own ends. They'll use the strike for things that are totally unrelated to the dispute at hand. So it's difficult to monitor that, unless if it rears its head as in a particular form or shape. But if that involvement becomes criminal, for an example, then you have options. But if it's the one that is merely there providing support and so on, and then you may find that the actual union that is meant to be in dispute is not leading the strike at all, but if the strike is led by other people, it becomes an issue. In Marikana, there was a problem of the church. I mean, the church, not only it wanted to limit itself to keeping and preaching hope and helping people to behave in a particular way, it actually wanted to sit in a bargaining table. It wanted to sit there. It even attempted to seek to monopolize the report back processes. That, look, you don't report back at Mountain, we will. We've been in the room where these discussions were taking place. We will report back. The unions are like, hey, those are our members. So you do find those things, and they'll happen from time to time. And I don't think the law is the best instrument to prevent that. I think we need to take a look back and see how we can manage that. Thanks, Jen.
Good morning, with regard to the question of whether directors should perhaps be replaced with commission chairpersons, we are actually of the opinion that this, the phrasing as it stands at the moment, is correct. Because if members have to look at the principal act, director is defined in the Labour Relations Act to mean the director of the commission appointed in terms of Section 118. And then in terms of Section 118, the functions of the director is also outlined, which include manage and direct the activities of the commission and to supervise commission staff. And it also indicates that this director is a senior commissioner. So perhaps if members take the comparison with the court, the judge president in a court assigns cases on the court roll to a judge to decide. or to deal with. It's not the court that does that. Here, in this similar situation, the director of the commission, the senior commissioner, will assign such a dispute to a commissioner to deal with. So in using the word director, as is already clarified in terms of definitions clause, this actually provides more certainty as to whose function is and whose responsibility it is to take charge of assigning and managing. So, in terms of our view, I think there's consensus amongst us that the phrasing is correct and legal.
Thank you, sir.
Ki patra kari hai.
You might want to say that the real world.
I've read to engage like Honorable Father Vincent and try to the director thing and the commission. It's not that when you ask points of clarity you can engage. Those who want to engage and put their views forward today, they're free to do that. Everything we do here is recorded. Whatever you say won't get lost. So,
thank you, Chair and members. 27 is just replacing the Supreme Court with the High Court in terms of the Labour Court. I think it's just straightforward. Yeah, straightforward. Now, COP 28, if there are no questions, there on 27. COP 28, this is another area where we interfere with the independence of the judiciary. In this case, we're making conditions for judges better. The Labour Court, the judges of the Labour Court presently are inferior to all other judges. All other judges are appointed on a permanent last tenure basis. Judges of the Labour Court are permanent, appointed on the last tenure basis. Judges of the High Court on the permanent last tenure basis. The Labour Court, they've got a tenure of 10 years. The conditions and the remuneration are not the same as the judges of the High Court. And as a result of that, many experienced practitioners in the field would rather opt to go to the High Court than to the Labour Court, although they are experienced labour lawyers, because of the conditions. You're having difficulty to attract, and the Labour Court becomes a second option. If the practitioner can't make it in the High Court, then they will accept the Labour Court. And that has been the problem over the years. And then the Department of Justice started the process in 2003, even before the Supreme Court bill process, to rationalize the court. And as part of that process, they put his proposal. That's what that process is trying to do, exactly it is. This proposal was put on the table. You know the history of the Supreme Court bill more than me. It has been pegging on for the last, 10 years now? It has not yet seen the light of day. Now, what we've done here, after a discussion with the judges of the Labour Court, the parties, NEDLAC, there's agreement in all of them. And also in the Supreme Court bill, the last version changed, saying that the different legislation should deal with also some aspects of the different areas there. And we took exactly the clauses in the Supreme Court bill as they were that relate to the labor relations, to the labor court judges, and put them in here. And we know that also the state law advisors indicated also this issue, that there is a letter that was written to the chairperson on this, by the other committee for the state law advisors. They also agreed, what they put on the table was that if the Supreme Court bill comes through before this law, then we don't have a reason to continue with this. If that comes to, from where I'm sitting, it's unlikely. That's the hope, but I think it's unlikely. But if it doesn't come to before the LRA, then LRA, we think, should go ahead as it is, so that it can deal with the conditions of judges in the Labour Court. Nothing prevents the Supreme Court's bill amending the LRA later if it comes in, if they want that, and just delete this if they want to put it there. But we've got to try, I mean, this is meant to deal with coalitions of judges of the Labour Court. And there's no contradiction between the legislation. It's just that it's exactly the same what the Supreme Court bill is saying. In law, I mean, what is not desirable is contradiction. You can have clauses in two laws. The Basic Condition of Employment Act has got the presumption who's an employee. The LRA has got the same presumption on who's an employee. Duplicate issues, as long as they do not contradict, sometimes it's not that bad. But what we're saying from our side, if members are worried about that, that law can amend this legislation if it comes later and delete this section from the LRA if that's what they want. Our interest is that we've got to deal with the conditions of judges of the Labour Court and make them similar to coalition of judges in the High Court. And that will enable the Labour Court to attract quality judges into the Labour Court. And that is good for the economy. That is good for the labour market. That's what Clause 28 is intending to do. I'm not going to go through on each clause of it, but in principle, that's what it's doing. It's improving the coalition of judges of the Labour Court. I'll take clarification.
You commented about superior court bills, and asked that had been with justice for more than 7 years, and there is no way that they can finish that bill before we do ours. But in case by the grace of the Holy Spirit, that maybe they finish this next month, then it will be much easier for us, and because then we'll drop this section and adopt whatever they have passed. But if it's the other way around, then we can at a later stage, if for instance the outcomes of the interaction produce something different from what we have, and then it will be much easier for us, because you say, you know, you drop this. And it's easier to drop something from a bill or from an act than when you are to add something. If we're adding something, you need, it's a very much involved thing, you know. But if you drop something, it's through consensus, and we're all happy, and then we drop it and go, you know, as long as it makes legal sense. And anyway, if it comes from the Justice Department, we take for granted that it will be hinged on the Constitution, because they've got equal access to the resources that we have, state law advisors and parliamentary legal teams. So there's a hand from Honorable Makuvela Mashele. Yes.
Chairperson, I want to check from the GM lawyers. not from the bush lawyers. with us factoring this amendment, and with us not waiting for the process on the other committee of justice dealing with this, does it mean that whichever comes first for the lawyers in the labour court, what you call in the labour court, and what would happen if their changes are actually saying the conditions should not be as what we are prescribing here? How will we deal with the contradictions?
I guess I did want to get another further clarity. Will this thing affect the LRA, or is it only going to talk to the remuneration and responsibilities of judges? is it going to affect the LRA, or is it just going to be just the deployment of judges, this one and this much, so all lawyers can, all judges can deal with the other cases of Kwesara, if you may. Father, give me that clarity, and I really need it more. Honorable. the honored Ms. Williams, you are honored.
Thank you, Keith. I know we have two Williamses here, the honorable one at the. Yeah. Keith, I just want to maybe just to simplify that. The Superior Court Bill, what it does, it seems to consolidate and like as Mr. Khalifi said, to consolidate and rationalize laws relating to the various courts. So as you said, the labor courts, they have a bit of a less favorable condition than the other courts and the other superior courts. So it's just to align it with that. But what the Superior Court Bill does, it doesn't reduce new legislation per se. In the Superior Court's bill, there's a schedule. Now, Schedule 2 amends its provisions of the Labor Relations Act. And those provisions are exactly the same as we have in our bill. So now what happens if we make those changes? It's fine, it can go through. But for example, if Justice wants to introduce something new, which is totally different to this, it would have to follow the same process as the committee would have if we introduce something new. So what they change, their changes can't be substantially different and introduce something new, but they can maybe tweak it along the lines. And as the chairperson said, the law advisors and the state law advisors are all from the same office. So we will confer, we will work together to make sure that those changes are aligned towards the committee. But when I certified this bill for the Department of Labor, at the time it was the Superior Court's bill, and at that time I had to take a decision whether to include it or take it out. And I think initially there was a bit of disagreement with my colleague who's doing the Superior Court's bill, but then we agreed that it's so much easier, as the chairperson said, to reject the clause if that committee accepts the clause. But my personal view, my personal opinion is that it's an amendment to the Labor Relations Act, and this committee is currently dealing with the Labor Relations Act. So I think it may be best suited for this committee to actually go ahead with that amendment, because then we look at the Labor Relations Act holistically in its entirety, and even these amendments, as it is aligned with, it's giving effect to the same objectives that the Superior Court's bill is doing. So I don't see any conflict or any clash here, but as we most likely finalize this bill before the other bill is finalized. But it's the same thing, but the only difference is it may be done by two different committees. That's the only thing, but the amendments are the same, everything is the same, and I think the objectives are the same as well. Thank
And this will help us quite a lot. I mean, if they are put on the same level, you know, because then it will reduce the load actually of many labor cases that have been in court for many years because of shortage of staff and, you know, and judges and all that. Yeah. And yeah. But I don't think we should dwell more on this. We've got something bigger out there that is facing us. So this I don't think we should spend more time on this. But can I respond to Mr. Mpani?
No, what I was going to say, Chair, is that just also to allay any anxiety about all this issue, the Supreme Court's bill, the section around the labor court has been consulted extensively. The justice consulted on it. Therefore, if they are going to come up with any changes to what is on the table, we will know about it. They will consult that, because this is as a result of a consultation between the Department of Labor and also Justice. We're part of that process. And if there's any change, it will be for the better, not for the worse. And those changes will then come through a process of consultation also, before they even come to Parliament, if it's going to be different thing.
Well,
there's
a
next.
Are there fair questions on this one, points of clarity about this remuneration of judges? The judges, because I want us to close it and then not go back to it again. Yeah, there are no apologies for this meeting, that's why I did not deal with apologies. And let me acknowledge the presence of the PMG and a member from the communication, staff from the communication department in Parliament. Yebo. Yeah, Khalif.
The next one, 429. Technical arrangement, the country issue, is any and only law where it is because the labor does not have a jurisdiction on its unresolved dispute in terms of its laws. Remember, dispute must go first to the CCMA, and the CCMA then from there to the labor court, the same thing. Yes. And the only thing that we're adding is any other employment law. If there's a dispute in terms of the DDA, it should go also its process, or the issue, the other employment law, YF, and all that stuff. That's 29, we don't think it's coming. That's what, and this is consistent with the other change that was made where we add any employment law on it, and there's no disagreement amongst the parties on that.
Yeah.
30? Yeah. 30. Presently, you've got a situation where if the department dismisses Kola, not me, if the department dismisses Kola and Kola take up a case against the dismissal, the real lawyers raise point in limit at the CMA. We don't raise them, they raise the point in limit. And as it is now, and the CMA makes a ruling on that point in limit, they might say to the CMA, Commissioner, we've got the point in limit to raise. We do not think that the CMA has got jurisdiction on this case because of blah, 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 blah. And the CMA make a ruling. And then the lawyers, says we're not happy with your ruling. They say we're taking your ruling to the labor court. Therefore implying that the case must wait. We have not discussed the substance. It's a ruling. They say we take your ruling, Commissioner, to the labor court. We're taking you on review on your ruling. The labor court decides and say the Commissioner was correct. They say, no, we take the decision of the labor court to the labor appeal court. The end result of that is that you're not having the case, you have not had the case yet. You dismiss. He's not earning a salary. He's waiting for his case. This section now says that it should be on exceptional cases where the labor court hear those matters. The labor court should only hear matters about a case after the CCMA has finalized the case. You can't have cut shorts on the processes. If you say you've got an issue about a body linear about jurisdiction, you can argue that case. The CCMA rules on it. If you don't challenge that ruling, you can challenge that ruling after the CCMA have decided. On the basis of our ruling, let's hear now the case. We put evidence on the case and the CCMA, let us assume, decides that he's been dismissed unfairly. He must be reinstated. Now the department challenge that one case into the labor court. Then they would say, the first thing, Your Honor, we believe that the CCMA did not have jurisdiction because of this count. We've raised this issue in the commission. The commissioner rules against us on the issue. We think the commissioner erred in that ruling on this basis. And we want the court, before even going to merit, to also address the issue of point limit. They can do that now. This section says the court should only deal with those issues after the CCMA has done it, in order to avoid this kind of delay that I'm taking. This is an area that has been argument by parties at NEDLAC. Lawyers are not happy. Lawyers are not happy. You had submission made here around this area, and saying that it's a waste of time and money to continue with the case, only to find out later that the system didn't have the jurisdiction. And we say both is that we've taken a policy decision that says it might be that, but fairness and justice will be. We sided more with the side of the employee that is waiting for the judgment, and the effect it's having on that employee for waiting that judgment when you take up this board. And we could take many of them. Many of these court short cases, delaying the cases in terms of this. And that's what this section is all about. It's not closing the door altogether. It gives the court the right to decide if it's in their opinion it is fair, just, and equitable to disregard this restriction. The court can do that. You can go to court and say, because of these issues, the court will listen and say, we think it's fair just in this case to ask the CMA to hold on and let's hear your case. It let it be the court that decided that. And under exceptional cases, it can't be a normal situation where every time you apply to go to the court to challenge the CMA ruling, not decision, it's a ruling about the process itself, the process should stop. And this is what it's trying to do, trying to say that there are many people that are affected by this point in Lima. I don't know what this point in Lima is, you know.
Point of before.
That's what 29 really is the first thing B is trying to do. And maybe let's hold him there and see before we finish, they will see.
Sometimes you end up in the
thank you. It was just with regard to that direct commission aspect that I wanted to make a comment on, but I think I can't remember another issue, sorry.
Thank you very much. Honorable Hanare.
You're the defend the lawyer?
And just wants to automatically. I'm the lawyer for him.
I understand what Mr. Mkalipe is saying about the fairness and siding with the employees. I mean, I know the problem is that the law was abused by people who wanted to just frustrate their work. But have you checked whether, because the people who made a presentation to us were this association of lawyers, something like that. They will probably want to take this up to the Constitutional Court if we just ignore them. Have you checked whether this fairness is constitutional?
There's another question related to that from the member. Or on this, the input from Mukalibu, the presentation. Yeah, if not so, Mukalibu.
We're confident. I mean, there's nothing unconstitutional about it. They have not raised also constitutionality when they raised the issue. They raised the issue of cost to the members, the nuisance factor, that they must continue with the case and challenge it later. But our colleagues who satisfy the bill, look at that, they might have something to say.
Dr. Lewis, did you hand up? Okay, good. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Just maybe to clarify, the issue here, why we don't have a problem with it, is that the discretion still lies with the court. And like our colleague said, as long as it's just and fair, so this is not a constitutionality issue. We don't see anything in this clause on which somebody can challenge a constitution. It's the discretion remains and the fairness remains. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Baya.
That made the issue of all the cases.
and the other one will discuss this one as soon as possible, because the more debate that we have, what are going to do then? Clause 31 is just a problem that you are at the mercy of the president of the court on when to the rule for you. In the previous president of the court, that Gordon, which is the net one to 10 years. And the court of law was not in the net alone, since it has been removed. But there has been attempts to set up again. Now, part of the government has not reported the provision in law that indicates when the report should be issued. Because the room is dealing with the rules of court, and court decision, there are things that affect the men that we need to, from time to time, see whether
the rules are still serving their purpose. And it's linked with the CCMA also of changing of the rules, and that's what this is. There's no disagreement by all parties on this one. But, yeah.
Honorable Sander,
Chair, my apologies. Mr. Ngalipi is a bit fast for me. On the page 16 as well, Amendment 30, just above that, we also had the comment that the wording, and I'm reading from D5, adjustment of the Labour Court must stand it down as soon as reasonably possible. I don't know if Mr. Ngalipi refers to that as well, but there was the comment that this is too vague, and that some of the public hearings or submissions that we had asked for this to be tightened up and made a little bit stronger. Sorry, did I miss that, Mr. Kalipi, or did you ignore that?
I think you missed it. But remember, we had a long debate last week on the issue, on this issue, and about the interference of the division of powers between the judiciary and the executive. Our little friend saying that, indicating that this would be unconstitutional. The original proposal, as we reported the last time, was 6 months. And what came out of the statement by us was as soon as possible, precisely because they were saying that would be unconstitutional to tell a judge when they must issue their judgment. And we had a long debate and discussion about this issue last week.
And the thing is that we should not, if we are seeing something to get similar ways last week, we shouldn't forget that, because these things are linked to our discussion.
Okay. I don't think that the lawyers would have changed their mind since last week and say this is constitutional. We can try it, but I don't think that they've changed their mind. You know, lawyers do. This is an opinion. They can change their opinion.
I speak legal body language.
Okay, 32. This section is trying to deal with all those consultants, basically. Many people are consultants who go out and represent people in the labor court. And they do this by charging a fee for that representation. And this is what he's trying to deal with here. He's basically trying to deal with people who go to court and represent vulnerable workers and take away their money. It's not about the money that you pay to a lawyer is go to trust. I mean, that's not about that. This is about real consultants. No, consultants.
Is that the word you
consult? Those. That's what we're trying to deal with. And it's preventing them now charging that fee to the workers on that.
At last.
Yes. I mean, I'll take these questions on that one. Section 23, it's in sync with the one where we're taking up the Supreme Court, where we're inserting that the Labour Court or the High Court is just technical amendment, correcting an omission, basically, for the big issue. Clause 34 is also another technical one. Adjusting the word from that office, the appointment of judges, about the appointment of the judges, the fact that they can resign from the office, and and the citation, correcting the citation, there's really nothing. It's a technical amendment. 35. This amendment is making changes to Section 186 and link with the changes that we're making in Section 198 on fixed term contract. We are going to see the changes that we're making in 198C, if I'm not mistaken. We'll see those changes where we talk about fixed term contract. Now, in the present Section 186, if you look at Section 186 B, and it deals with termination of a contract. And it also introduced the notion that if you are on fixed term contract, and you reasonably expected the employer to extend the contract, and the employer does not extend that contract, that could be regarded as a dismissal. That's basically what it says, the first area. It's adding just the way it engaged on the fixed-term contract. Therefore, if I'm engaged on a fixed-term contract for 5 years, and I reasonably expected that the employer would give me another contract. There will be reason for that. And I go to the CCMA and say, I have this victim contract. This is what the employer did to raise my expectation for me to expect that my contract will be extended. Maybe the employer has written to me and said that we intend to extend your contract. Or the employer said my contract was for 3 consecutive 5 years. I had a 5-year contract, it ended, it was renewed. I had another 5-year contract, it ended, it was renewed. Now this time, the contract is not renewed, somebody else will take it. Then the law says that I had an expectation that the contract would be renewed, a reasonable expectation that a reasonable person would be able to accept. I should be able then to go and say, by not extending that contract, it's a dismissal. And I can go and show the commission why I think it's a dismissal. And the other party will come and say why they did not create that expectation. They should not show the commission and say, we did not create the expectation. this is not correct, this person is lying, this is what is happening. That's what this is introducing here. Or, if you are on an independent contract, you are permanent, and then the employer says to you, look, I want you to work now on a different condition, lesser condition. Offer you a contract which is different what you have, whatever reason. You should be able to approach the system on the basis of the dismissal. And your employer must come in and argue why they are doing this without consultation. Remember Section 188 deals with this issue. If a company is in distress, it's not able to operate. Nothing prevents that company using Section 198 and say, well, we are going to retrench. We don't have a choice because we don't have orders. But there's an opportunity that we might not retrench if you agree to work, for example, 2 days instead of 4 days. Now the employees have the choice. Either they take retrenchment or they want that, the consultation part that goes on. It can be done. You can change the condition through that process. But if you just change the condition, and the Section 186 now make it easy for employers to be able to take that as an unfair labor practice in terms of order. That's what this first part, the 35, really does. It means those two things. It deals with the fixed-term contract, the reasonable expectation, it deals with a failure of an employer to retain me on the same or similar condition. They change the condition. They say, well, we'll retain you on a less favorable condition. I'm not sure whether there's any question of clarity on that one.
Yes, thank you. Honourable members, I think we can have our questions of clarity and engage Mr. Kalidou on the section 35. Thanks. If not, can we proceed?
Okay. Now, 36. This is a big one. This is a big one, 36. The small amendments, you add a small section that says refusal by employees. That's what you're adding there. You're adding small words, refusal by the employees, to Section 187, and then you're adding them and they are at the end of that. But it's a big one in terms of law. This is the famous Prizeal case. This is this case where, in terms of the law present, if the court in price matter argued and decided that let me put it this way, the intention of the act, where the act came into place, was that employers should be able to lock out employees. And the lockout is intended to force employees to agree on something. Let us say, I run a conversation, my workers board on strike, they are demanding 12,500. And as an employer, I put on the table 10,000. I say, I'm offering you 10,000. cannot afford 12,500. In terms of the law now, the employer can lock you out and say you don't come in here until you accept my demand as employer, which is 10,000. That's what the lockout is. It's the employer saying accept the demand of 10,000 or suffer. It's not a dismissal, it's a lockout. You saying lockout. But phrase mental allows a dismissal on the basis of that. Now this is what this proposal is changing. It's making it clear that employers can lock out, but lockout is not a dismissal. Just like employees can go to strike demanding the 12,500, the employer can put a demand and lock them out on the basis of that. And there's been contradictory cases around this area of 30187. The present law said, to compel an employee to accept a demand in respect of any matter of mutual interest between the employer and employee. Now, what we are changing, just so that it is clear here, instead of saying to compel an employee to accept a demand, it's to read the following: a refusal by employee to accept a demand in respect of any matter, the employer can then, if the employee refuses, lock them out. And that's the issue that is trying. There are big differences now between the parties at level for this issue. Because as expected, like the interpretation of the court on this issue, it is labor, all labor organizations accept the changes that we are making. And we think that this amendment is putting back what was the intention of the law. If this amendment goes in, is the intention of the law. The law states clearly that you cannot be dismissed. You cannot be dismissed for refusing. This is a power struggle. If you refuse to accept the 10,000, you're out of work, you don't earn a salary, you're not dismissed. You're locked out. And that's the principle that's been raised here. The courts have allowed dismissal on the basis that I did not accept. Now, even when I come later, the problem is solved. The employers in Transmetal dismissed workers on this issue. And what we're saying is that was not the intention of the law. The intention of the law was to put a lockout against a strike. A lockout is a strike by the employer. Now, a strike is not a dismissal. A lockout can't be a dismissal. That was the intention in 95. Fred Mitchell said otherwise. And that's what we're trying to correct, that anomaly. Well, as I've said, business, in the airport this year, I would say the same. It's in their interest. I mean, I'm not surprised. I wouldn't think that they're representing the American members effectively if they don't. When the court makes wrong decisions in my favor, why should I complain? If they make wrong decision against you, you will cut. If they make a wrong decision in my favor, allow all the way to the bank. And that's the situation.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. You may be stroking my aspirations. I think the starting point is that our law says workers have the right to strike. And a quid pro quo for the employer is that they have the right to lockout. So the two rights stand side by side. So the instrument of lockout was designed as an instrument for the employers to respond in a strike situation. So workers will use the strike as a tactic to twist the arm of the employer so that he accedes to their demand. The converse or the opposite side, that the employer would use the lockout to force the arm of the workers to accept his offer. These two instruments were meant to complement each other in the opposite direction, of course. But what has happened in the case in question is that the employers saw an opportunity in exercising the right to lockout as an opportunity to retrench or to dismiss workers. So what we're trying to do in this amendment is to make it very clear that the right to lockout cannot be abused or extended as an instrument to dismiss. And I think the sum total of what is being attempted here is to limit the right to a lockout to what it was intended for, so that it can't get stretched way beyond what it was intended to do. And the case of UMSA is a classical case where we're basically saying we need to clean up, we need to fine tune this area so the instrument is used for what it was intended. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable members, Honourable Masrumu, welcome. welcome, Honourable Manama. You, Honourable Mutau, followed by Honourable Makruvela Mashal.
No, actually, I was going to say I'm grateful for the explanation, because I was grappling with the issue, but now that it's put in perspective. In other words, for me, the lockout vis-a-vis the strike, those are sort of counterbalancing powers, and they should end there. And then, if you want, you've got to engage another process. Okay.
Honourable Makruvela Mashal.
Thank you, Chairperson. And I would want to assume this is all in a protected strike. Or protected demonstration or action taken by workers. Because recently, we've been hearing in media lots of workers or the employers saying they're going to dismiss them if they do not return to work. But most of them have embarked on unprotected demonstration. And, well, as much as this is not related to, I would want Mr. Mkhalipi to just come in on the issue of intimidation, because at times there would be those that want to go back to work, and they would fear intimidations of those that are still embarking on the demonstration, even if it's protected. Because I would assume in the lockout, the work no pay rule would apply. How do we go about in such cases?
Before you even answer that one, I'd like to add something. From reading in the papers, there are lots of contradictions in terms of what people report. Some reporters will talk about an illegal strike, and others say, no, there is no, all strikes are legal. I mean, you don't have such a thing as an illegal strike in South Africa. All strikes, it's legal to strike in this country. But I think the difference is whether the strike is protected or not. You can only have an unprotected strike or a protected, let's say protracted or protected, yeah. sorry. I use English as my fifth language. Unprotected and protected strikes. There is nothing called an illegal strike. Which one is correct?
You correct in terms of the law, technically, when you speak to real lawyers, they will tell you that. They will tell you that in terms of our law, the concept of illegal strike does not exist. There's no such thing as a legal strike, but there's not even an illegal strike. The strike is a constitutional right. The strike. What is there in our law? And then the lawyers like us use that to mean illegal, illegal. Our law talks to two things. Talks to procedural and unprocedural strikes. It does not talk to legal. It says this strike is procedural, therefore the consequence of that procedural strike is protection. You are protected against dismissal because you follow all the procedures. That's where the legality comes in. Lay people like us say that's legal strike because you follow the procedure. Unprotected strike is an unprocedural strike. The one that the Honorable McCormick talked about is a strike that does not follow the procedure. Therefore, it's a strike that does not have the protection of the law. Therefore, you're correct. In terms of the LRA, you never see the word legal or illegal strike. Yes. But that's what we understand to mean a procedural. It will mean legal. Unprocedural, it will mean illegal, technically. But the law doesn't deal with that. But let's come to your question also. The issue of the lockout, it's a lockout by the employer. It's the employer that must do the right thing for the in this situation. We're not talking about the strike. We're talking about the lockout, where the employer says, I'm locking my gate, not coming in. And for the lockout to work, it's got to take place before a strike. Doesn't make sense to lock out people who are already out on track. I mean, what does it say? The intention of the law in 1995, when it was introduced, it introduced two concepts, a strike and a lockout. And for the lockout, they have said to work is that the union that is negotiated will bring a deadlock. The union is busy organizing for a strike. Then the employer can give notice. 48 hours notice, the same notice that the union must give and say, I'm locking you out tomorrow. Before the strike. And then when they come in, the employer says, you're not coming in yet. The lockout is preventing the union to organize a proper strike. It's disorganizing, it's a preemptive a lockout by the employer that says, you have not accepted the offer that's on the table. We went through the process, it went through conciliation, I'm giving you 48 hours to lock out. And they lock them out. And the union is disrupted in the sense that the union intended to go out on strike next week. It's planning this process. Intended to go out on strike next week, the employer locked them out today. And says, you only come in here if you accept this demand, which is 10,000 that I'm putting on the table. You'll only be able to come in that case if you accept that, the 10,000.
I want to know the process or the procedure in the payment at that time. Is the employee having or earning at that time? Because the employer would have locked them out, but they are earning something. You know, is it what rule applies there in terms of their remuneration at that specific period when they are locked out?
It's no work, no pay. It's exactly the strike.
Yes.
When the worker goes on strike, they don't get paid. When the employer goes on a strike, the employer strike is locking out. You don't get paid. The employer could stand up in the gate there with the argument and say, anybody that wants to work, there's an agreement that says, I'm offering you 10,000. If you sign the agreement, you go in. You want to break a strike now. Employees are coming because precisely they are not going to earn. sign the agreement, go in, he works. So that those ones who sign the agreement end up in the street, they are not earning anything. It's allowed, it doesn't flow. It's a strike by the employer. And the employer in the chain does not get production because he has locked out all his workers. Doesn't get production. He'll get production if they break in the strike, or if the employer can escape labor, other people to come in and replace. They can. It's allowed to flow. But there's no pain in going out on the lockout window. But the lockouts in South Africa are rare. They've never, it's really rare. They've taken place, but very rare. Precisely because a lockout is only effective before a strike. As I've said, it doesn't make sense to lock out people who are already on strike. They're already on strike. It's not going to change anything. And that's what this area talks about. We are going to, there is an area that talks to the issues around, the issues that they are raising, violence, picketing. We're still coming to that section on the issue that we're in. I'm not sure that we'll finish it, but I think we're still coming to that. Yeah.
There is this saying,
there are wild cat strikes. Can we have a wild cat lockout?
There is. When an employer, you come to work today, the following morning you arrive, nothing happens. The following morning you arrive, the employer has locked you out and says, you can only come in here if you agree to work a 10-hour shift. Or the employer says, I'm changing my shift now, I'm introducing shift in this company. You will work 6 to 2 and to work, and you only come in if you are prepared to come to work those shifts. There was no discussion, there was nothing, there was no conciliation, there was nothing. Just like the employees who will say, not coming to work. If the employer doesn't know anything, they say, give us 12,500. That's a wildcat lockout by the employer.
Nosha, I wanted to say to you the during the now I think Goldsons, when the workers went on a Wednesday strike, they locked them out of their hostel, and the condition was that if they go back, I mean they can only go back into the hostel if they are going to go back to work. And I think it fits nicely into that example. It was just a counter by the company. So it actually can happen. They actually do it. A wildcat lockout. Yeah, thanks.
I think upon that, in law, if your reaction is against an unlawful, unfair action, will not be regarded as real. I mean, let's say if the employer change condition will come in, our wages should be 12,000, come in on Friday, he'll say that's 2,000. And as a result of that, there's no discussion, no words, nothing. And we go out on strike. Law allows those issues. You know, if it's a change in conditions as a result of that, and the courts are sympathetic in those wildcat strikes, that as a result of those drastic actions, I don't know, just which section of the law I can check that this is that. Now, in the case that you're referring to, the workers are already out on strike. The employer is locking them out. Sometimes they don't give them food. They switch off the water. They switch off the water for the car or electricity. Say that this is what you are giving for you to provide work. That's why you got the house for you to work here in the farm. Now you're out on an unprofessional strike. You want me to continue to give you food, water, and electricity, yet you're out on strike, and employers lock out their property. That's not that lockout that the law is talking about. The law you're talking about, a lockout from work, when they lock you out and say, you're not coming in to do work. Do what work? They say, no, you're coming in because we want you to agree to reduce your salary from 12,000 to 5,000. And they've gone through the processes, just like the strike. You've got to follow a process for that to be procedural. And the same process in conciliation of the issue, the declaration of dispute, getting a certificate from CCMA, that certificate says the employer can lock you out, the employees can go strike.
If we continue by wildcat lockouts and so on, you will need a fighter for all the rest. But, now, Chairperson, this section 187 actually deals with automatically unfair dismissals. It hasn't got to do, or it's not restricted to strikes at all. And then it says, you know, you cannot dismiss, it is a dismissal is automatically unfair,
yeah,
if the employer has the reason for the dismissal, said the employee participated or reported the strike and so on. But then it goes on, and that is why I don't quite understand this. It says a dismissal is automatically unfair if the reason for this dismissal is a refusal by employees to accept the demand in respect of any matter of mutual interest between them and their employer. It's automatically unfair. By that it means, you know, there's no argument about it. That's my understanding of it. So if employees refuse to accept a demand by an employer, and I think you have now said you need to say shift hours, or you must work through lunchtime, you know, the shop must stay open, or we must start operating on a Sunday, and so on. What are the other remedies then? If employees just say we refuse to accept a demand in this matter of mutual interest, please, you must help me to understand it, because I
well, the best remedy is that there is for the employer to lock the workers out. That's the best remedy, is for the employer to go out on strike. The employer wants to change, it will shift, different shifts. The employees disagree. Then the employer, in terms of the law, has got one remedy to lock them out. If the employer is giving access to that, then the employees now lose wages, not dismissing them. You lose wages. And this law says it is then unfair, automatically unfair, to dismiss them because they refuse to accept the demand. You can lock them out, but you can't dismiss them. And locking them out is an attempt by you to force them to accept that reality, that shift partner change. It will mean that they are not going to be locked out, they are not going to end salary, and possibly a week or two, in the sense of their refusal. That's the remedy that you've got. But if you say, look, we've got problems here. We are not, let's say if I was an employer, this is what I'll do. I'll say, look, we've got problems here. We are not delivering on our product. We are losing customers. We've got options here. Either we retrench as a result of that because we're losing the customers, some of whom are going, or we address this issue. And then you discuss in order to avoid, and you also avoid the retrenchment of the organization and say, these are the solutions that we've got. You're not locking them out. You're not changing their conditions. You're now negotiating about the future of the company on the basis of the loss of the what is operational requirements. We could discuss those issues around there. But I mean, if workers refuse to accept changes, the only remedy that you got is lockout. The same thing, if workers want more money from you, the only remedy in terms of law is strike. They can't go to court and say we want 2,500 as an increase. They can't go even to the minister, although they can go to the minister. But reality, the minister can't do anything about that. The only thing that they can do on mutual interest dispute, even the mutual interest dispute, the employees can only go out on strike, the employer can only lock out. That's the essence of the law, and that's what it means. Now, what this is talking is that it says now, fragmental says exactly the same issue, and says then, allow the employer to dismiss employees who refuse to accept the employer's demand. Fragmental allow that dismissal. And that's the change that we're making here. That the law, if you read that section as you've read it, it says automatically unfair. An unfair action when you dismiss employees as a result of their refusal to accept what they're demanding. And the law, the way it was written previously, this is what they used to have dismissal, because it says to compel the employees to accept a demand. In first mental, they argue that we're not comparing them to accept demand. They were refusing to accept the demand. That's why we dismissed them. And the court allows it, that dismissal. And that's what we're trying to correct here. But in terms of law, employer has got no other option if employees reject an offer. You've got to lock them out.
For myself, there's a strike. People, a procedural strike, and then the workers are so well organized that there are no chances of any skilled labor going into the factory and continuing with production. And the workers are standing firm that no, we want 12,500. Production stops 100%. Then the employer says, I'm not going to afford this money. Then what happens? Because then it ever continues. The workers are not under pressure because they've got support from the community that they live in. So whether the hostel is closed or not, it doesn't affect them that much. They are staying on the Gopi, they've got their blankets there. They are determined to. You know, they make their own checks on the Gopi. And they manage to live for the next 2 months. Well, then what happens? And where does the law come in terms of intervention at that level?
The first thing is that Section 150 kicks in, also could kick in this case, where the CCMA try and bring the parties together. That's the only area that you could use here. But remember this, a strike is intended to help the company. We can't pretend that's not the case. We're going out and strike to help you so that you can see, agree with what we're saying. Now, when you help somebody, I mean, it's just like when you, I know, I mean, talking to MPs here, the law does not, when you discipline your children, it helps them. Whether you withdraw your pocket money, what they withdraw your pocket money helps them. Now the issue that strikers need to bear in mind is that you should not help the company in such extent that the company ceases to exist. That's the issue, because what might happen if workers go out on strike in order to help the company, and let's say the strike is effective, as you say, go on for a long time, there's nothing happening, the company can apply for bankruptcy. Nothing prevents the company doing that. So, look, we can't pay our creditors. This is what's happened. When that happens, then the workers lose more. If the company gets bankrupt, they lose their job. That's what workers need to assess in this. The strike is intended to help the company, but in helping the company, you should not help yourself. And there's that possibility that it might happen. Therefore, on that question that the Honourable Member you're asking is that, Chair, that what happened in this situation? That's what happened. Because the strike is intended to hurt the company, it depends how much hurt is that. If the hurt is such that it's going to kill the child, that's why I use an example of the child. If you want to discipline a child and you hurt your child in such a sense that the child might end up dead, that's no more discipline. The same thing in the situation. If the strike, at the end of the day, is going to render the company to go under is not worth striking for. Because whatever is going to come, they will provide. And these are the issues that parties need to take into consideration. And this is where Section 150 might assist the party. The commissioner might be able to say to the party, guys, look what's happening. You are fighting for 2,500. But you might lose what you've got. The 5,000 that's earning, you might lose that because the company is going to go under. If this continues for another month, this is what's going to happen. This, what are the creditors are already saying now on this company? Because nothing prevents creditors. Creditors don't care whether your workers are on strike or not. If the banks are not paid their money for whatever reason, they are the first ones to go in and claim their money if it ends there. Therefore, if the strike is effective, there's no cap labor, there's nothing, and it hurts the company, and the employer, one would assume that the managers will realize that this is hurting us more than we bargained for, and we've got the solution. And that's what strike is there for. Strike is intended to force the other party to your side, and they've got to sit down and say, what is it worth for us not to give them the 12,000 and continue not giving them and lose the company, or can we give them the 12,000 and reduce half of them? Those are the options that managers will have to take and say, well, we'll give you 12,000 but we'll retrench 50% of you later because the company cannot afford 50%. Those are the options that are out in terms of
situation. Will members like to engage now, or should we take a 10-minute break? And then have a meeting of the paymentees outside. Thank you. 10 minutes break.
Yeah. I'm not going to get it. I'm not going to get it. I'm not going to get it. Just in case somebody looks like me. from this matter. It was me. It was in the
meeting.
Yes. It's my ass, right? I was in the meeting.
Like a true law.
You know?
Totally
yeah, no, absolutely. I was no idea. What takes it on the scene of this life?
But law makes me for paradise, don't you think?
Yeah.
Because you're always looking for loopholes.
Of course.
I know I'm still a student, but I'm definitely paranoid now.
So you're a law student?
Yes. I'm paranoid about everything.
Yeah, no. Wait, it's only in the beginning. It's about being a mentor.
I love the pace we are moving. We are moving a bit faster, and that is very good. Are there questions that members would like to ask Mr. Mukalipo on this last presentation? If not so, Mr. Mukalipo, Tolka period, Tavarish. Tolka.
The prison law. The prison law allows, Section 188 allow presently what we call pre-dismissal hearing. This means that if the department wants to dismiss me, they can have a pre-dismissal hearing. That hearing is basically a hearing that the department will hold with me. They will bring a commissioner, somebody who is an arbitrator, to hear the case. It's not going to be Mkhize hearing the case. It's going to be somebody independent hearing the case. And I go in and put my case. The department comes in, put its case. And Mkhize, who is independent, makes the decision and says, yes, I agree with the government department, you must be dismissed. Now, in terms of the present law now, if we go through that process, what we call pre-dismissal hearing, and I'm dismissed as a result of that process, that's the end. That's the end of the case. I can't go to the CCMA, because that process replaces the CCMA process. I can only go to the labor court and review the decision with all its problems. Pre-dismissal process, this action was introduced to enable employers and employees to decide quickly on their cases. Remember, I'm saying that if you go through that process, there's a pre-dismissal process, I get dismissed. That decision to dismiss is the same as the decision of the CCMA. Therefore, there's no challenge to the CCMA. And this was an attempt to speed up dismissals. And it has not taken off. Parties have not agreed on this issue. Not parties, specifically trade unions have not bought on this. and it has not taken off. Now, what is being changed in this issue? It's not changing everything that caused this pre-dismissal. It is an assumption that maybe because it's called pre-dismissal, it's supersupposed that you will be dismissed. Now, it's changing pre-dismissal to an inquiry. Because that's what it does, this section. If you look at this section, wherever there's pre-dismissal, it's put an inquiry. We think that way it might be sellable. Parties might be prepared to buy it. But it is a process that speedy dispute resolution. The employer says they spend a lot of time at the CCMA. This will make sure that they don't even go to the CCMA. There's nothing to spend at the CCMA. If they deal with their cases in terms of this, that's what Section 188 does, 37. All parties have agreed on this, whether it will succeed, the jury is out. But the present law as it is, it's exactly as it is. There's nothing that has been changed in the present law except the word inquiry and adding few words in terms of the employment law and all those issues. Otherwise, and we hope that it will encourage parties to use the process because it's geared to speed up dispute resolution so that employers don't have an inquiry in the workplace and then have to go to the CCMA. If they want to have one off, they can have that one in company and they don't have to go to the CCMA. That's what the 7 is there about. I can take questions.
The emphasis on the point that it should be with the consent of the employee.
If
the employee refuses, it cannot proceed.
Yeah.
Okay.
But remember, it's also called not only the consent.
Sorry, I'm checking my pen. It is the consent of the employee, or because it is in the contract of employment. The contract of employment gives consent. You can have it when you get employed on the first day, you sign a contract, your contract that you're given could include this. Remember, with dismissal, it's difficult to have this agreement when there's already a dispute. But when you want to employ Mkize and Mkize wants a job, and your contract says dispute between the company and Mkize will be dealt with in terms of Section 188, and he signs that contract. That's the consent that is given. And it's easier to get that consent if you as an employer. If I'm an employer, that's what I would do. Everybody coming in would sign a contract that says that dispute will be dealt in terms of this section. Because it's easier to get that consent because he wants a job, remember? And most of the time when people sign those contracts, they don't even read it. They look at the money side and they sign. They're happy with the money, they sign. And the contract says, dispute resolution and all this.
Let me know why you do this.
That was the question was intended. It was intended to take off cases from the CNA, to say, employers, you can have your cases. If you hold your cases in terms of this section, the CCMA is out of the picture. You don't have to go back to the CCMA. Now, with employees, I mean, if I don't sign this contract when I start and I do something, the longer I delay, especially in the public sector, the longer I delay the hearing, the better for me. Therefore, employees will more likely not agree on this because it's tended to speed up dispute resolution.
Very thank you.
Okay.
Can we move on?
38.
this election November excludes definitely MPs from the army for competitive this election gives the minister the power to issue the regulation that says if you earning the amount and you are dismissed, your dismissal would be regarded as fair. It doesn't matter what are the reasons. Your dismissal would be regarded as fair if the employer gives you a notice of 3 months or the employer pays you for 3 months. Now this, that two things, first thing it does,
it do away with at senior management level, this is about senior management, it do away with, I'm sure many of you are eagerly waiting for what we call the golden handshake, I'm not sure what golden is it. It does away with it. Because now all of a sudden, if the board want to dismiss you as senior manager, they don't have to offer you a golden handshake. The law says that they must only give you 3 months notice or pay you for 3 months. In a way, in the public sector, if you've got the director general who discounts on and the minister wants to dismiss that director general, for whatever reason, in terms of this, the minister would have now to give that director general 3 months notice or pay that director general for 3 months. They are not golden handshake. But I'm sure public officials who are looking after the public purse should work out this. Because now the time for golden handshakes are limited. The golden handshake will only be given because the parties want to give them. That's the first thing this is done. The second thing is that the 3 months can be extended. If the contract that you enter to says the notice must be here, then that's the notice. If some company, CEO, CFO, CEO, sign contract that says if there's any issue here, there'll be a year's payment for you and you go away. Remember when there's fight at the top.
And that becomes the platinum handshake.
Comes a platinum handshake. Yeah. When there's fight at the top, the grass starts. More when there's fight from the bottom. And this is what it's trying to do. Therefore, it doesn't deal with automatically unfair dismissal. Those are around gender, around race, and all those issues. No, those are not excluded. Talking about misconduct. Misconduct issues. I mean, if this law, if this proposal was in place, Kayama Jola would have been dismissed long time ago. Long time ago. Now he's been on suspension, earning salary, all of the issues. If this was on, the board would have said, we're giving you 2 months notice, or we're paying you for 3 months, go. And he'd have a case. Now, that's what this is intended to do. It says that the minister will publish this regulation. This regulation will indicate what the level, and if you look on the memorandum, extra memorandum, we give an indication there that we think that the level should be at the DG level. Anybody earning at the DG level, above and above, should be those that are excluded. And make sure that I'm not a DG, remember? I've got to protect myself. Well, if you want me to come into the net, you can make me a DG. and that's the indication that you need. At that level, there should be no fight. If there's no synergy between a DG and a minister, something will give. There should be not a big fight. If your minister does not want the DG must quietly go away. What is this? If the board does not want the chief executive or CEO of an organization, that the PO must go on carrying. There should be no issue, or the PFO, there should be no issue about big fights that affect the profitability of this organization.
Will it be you guys that I'm giving you 3 months, you'll work for 2 months, I'll pay you for 2 months, and they will work the 10 months that the cargo can be? How?
Yeah, the law says you must either pay or give notice. Therefore, I'm sure you can make a combination and say, I'll pay you for 2 months and you work 1 month. As long as 3 months, in terms of this proposal.
In lieu of notice.
I presume in that instance it would have to be a mutual consent. The two parties would have to agree the permutation. In other words, whether it's 3 months cash or something on the record.
Honorable, let's just get them so that we answer all of them at once. And Honorable Williams and Honorable McQuillan, I'm sure.
Thanks, Jefferson. I just want some clarity then on the clause 4, where the minister must, in consultation with NEDLAC, come up with that number of what level it is above. Before that, under the, it says in bold, dismissal of employees earning above the threshold. Will that come out then? Because as it stands here at the moment, anybody above earning above the threshold is now can get this can have their fundamental rights denied. And also, I've got a problem with this undermining the security of employment, this clause. So their fundamental rights are being denied, anybody earning above the threshold at the moment, according to what we have in front of us, and also it's undermining their security of employment. I just want to know, why is it that you want to do this to employees, even though they are the higher end of the employees, they still have rights, even though they earn a lot of money. So fundamentally, this is another backward step for workers. So I just want to know, my two questions are, why do you want to undermine security of employment, and also, will the section in bold that says dismissal of employees earning above the threshold be removed completely in order for section 4 of or subsection 4 to be implemented, or is it going to go into the act as it says employees earning above the threshold, which is only 172,000 rands, which basically puts everybody earning more than 15,000 rand a month into this threshold. Thank you.
Honorable Makula Masha.
Chairperson, I want also to come in with the issue of the threshold, because according to the definition that we would be having as a threshold in the previous section, it would be a certain amount of amount that the minister would describe as a threshold. But here, we're talking about high-earning employees, and if we use the threshold here, is it not going to contradict the whole thing? Because, I mean, when you're talking about like your proposal here, or the example that you are talking to right now, Kalipi, is about DGs and CEOs, those people that negotiate their salary packages, you know, and you at the same time, the amendment talks to threshold. So how are we going to distinguish between the two? And currently, I've heard, you know, of the proposals or the discussions there at NEDLAC, that, I mean, the proposals are talking from deputy director's position upwards and so on. Is this not going to reverse the gains of the very same employees that we are trying to defend? Because at times, in a department, you don't have to earn that much. But if you are part of the management and there are some issues, you can the very same law can be against you, and yet you'd find no position to defend yourself. You'd just be given the notice for 3 months, and all will be well with you.
Now,
if you can explain, because there might not necessarily be a contradiction, you know, but I think you need to explain people so that we understand what the difference. Our workers going to lose what they gave over many years through this, and if not so, why does it sound like they are going to lose something? So if you could explain.
I think this is
please, Mr. Mukhalipe, use English.
English. Okay. This is easy. I'm going to ask members to look at page 14 of their document, the bill. 14, 1-4. Mine is numbered, I'm not sure whether. Clause 25. Yeah. Now, whenever the law talks to threshold that is 172, it will say the threshold prescribed by the minister in terms of section 6(3) of the Basic Condition of Employment Act. When it says that, then it refers to that threshold that is 172, because that threshold is done in terms of the BCA. Any other threshold that is mentioned, if it doesn't have that citation that says in terms of section 6(3) of the Basic Condition of Employment Act, then it doesn't mean that threshold. Secondly, I want members to go to their document, page
82. Which
clause are we dealing with now? 38. 38. If you go to page 33, where is it? We give an indication there. Yes, which paragraph?
Paragraph 3.
The second line. In the memorandum we say this is intended, this is high threshold. We believe, we said to parties the network, the threshold that we're talking about here will be high. Remember, the memorandum is part of the law. And we say it will be high and in excess of NILO. That's what we're saying there. To try and make sure that it's separate from the one that the BCA is talking about. Now, we can't say that in the memorandum, that is part of the law, and not do that. Secondly, I remember looking on the TV some time ago, and I saw all the MPs sitting here clapping and agreeing with the NPC. What is that document, the big document? 20-year planning. When it was presented in Parliament, that document differs with us. The National Planning Commission says high earners are people earning 300,000. Yes. That's not us. It's the National Planning Commission that says that. We had a debate with them on that issue, and we raised the issue. And we disagreed and said, no, if you do that, it will do exactly what members are asking. It will take thousands and thousands of workers outside protection. And that's not what we intend to do. I thought I spoke English, over English, Chair. And differentiated between the two thresholds. And that the threshold that we're talking about, as I said, is at the DG level. It's not even at the DDG level, it's at the DG level, somebody above the DG and above, and in excess of a million. And well, we know, I mean, there are
consult members who earn the million, but it's very few. It's very few workers earn that. And the majority of workers are not going to be affected by this. And as we've said, the intention, the unintended consequences of this is going to do away with Golden Handshake, which are two that everybody, when Kayangula left, we got the left that day, he got this package. We think if this deal was in place, you would give him that package if you want to, because the law is in your hand. You wouldn't have got that. That's the unintended good unintended consequence of it. That was not the intention, but that's what it will translate into. It will make it easy to get rid of chief executive officers and the high end of organization without having to destroy the organization.
Yeah, I just want to compliment. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I think it's important for us to just remind ourselves as to what is the fundamental principle that underpins the labor law. And that is, simply put, the labor law is an instrument to protect workers in general and vulnerable workers in particular. Now, we seem to depart from the premise that says once you're in the million per annum threshold, you are disqualified from falling into that category of vulnerable workers. You meet category of being a worker in general, but the category of vulnerable workers in particular, unfortunately, once you're in that level, you opt out by default from the protection. So the labor law is nuanced, very much biased to a vulnerable worker. And I think the office of the minister is quite comfortable and will be comfortable even if the law were to protect only the vulnerable workers and leave those that fall outside that category. And the category right now, roughly speaking, if anybody who earns in excess of a million, or a million and above per annum, is considered not to be vulnerable, as it were. But of course it does not take away the constitutional rights and those other things that people can challenge in court, as it were. Thanks, Chair.
A million today and a million tomorrow might not be the same thing. Therefore, intention will also be taken into consideration as the minister advised the threshold. It can't be the threshold for a million for the next 10 years. I'm afraid, because I'll catch up with it. It must make sure that it must make sure that I don't catch up with it.
Honourable members, let's say I'll go this way, if it's okay with everybody. Honourable Van der Westhuizen, followed by Makubele Mashele, Williams, Manamel, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. We have been told in some of the public hearings that this may be an unfair discrimination, and that it therefore may not pass the test of constitutionality, the fact that everybody is equal before the law. And I would just like our legal people to please tell us what the convo judges would say should such a matter be referred to them. So you've been promoted to the status of convo judges. Thank you.
Just for me before, Honorable Makubele Mashele, there was this thing, who qualifies to access the CCMA? There was something to do with the
head of justice, lawyer.
No. That if you are a high earner, and then we had set the amount at some way, it's far below that 1 million rand. Was it the same as 1 million? Maybe if you could just deal with that one as you answer these other questions. I've made something that's a disjuncture somewhere in my mind, so if you could help me to link the two discussions. Makubele Mashele.
Chairperson, I also want to tap into the constitutionality of this clause, because as I sit here, I want a distinction between a particular worker and a worker. Because at the end of the day, workers are workers, you know. Whether I am so lucky to get a position of a CEO, but regardless of the position that I would be holding, I'm still a person who's employed according to the labor relations. But then the labor relations comes in and make a distinction to say, if I am earning this much, I should be exempted, or I should have less favorable conditions applied to myself when in a case where I need to be dismissed. You know, I'm just weighing the options. I'm not a bush lawyer. I'm not a lawyer also, but I'm just looking at the I'm just weighing the pros and cons here, looking at the situation today. A person is prejudiced just because they are earning that much. And will this also not say the very same worker who's going to be employed at that high end, say their contract of employment should at least not have the 3 months according to the LRA, say maybe 24 months or 12 months salary, just for their protection. And then looking at this amendment specifically, and looking at the gains that we've made for gender equality, you know, at the high end you still find very, you know, a drop of women CEOs and high-end earners there. And we know that, you know, with the challenges that we have as women, even in the boardroom, we still have to prove ourselves that we are equal to the task, and we're equal to the task that were previously given to men. Is this not going to reverse our high and extra effort to be in the boardrooms and to be up there? Because, you know, it's still a men's world, whether we like it or not. It's still a world that has so many colors. Look at this in this room. How many women are here? You know, looking at this portfolio committee of labor, there's only two women in this portfolio committee against how many members? You know, is it not... is it not going to say we are going to be prejudiced as women in the long run because of this clause? Because it would be easy to get rid of somebody, you know. It would be easy to you know, the issue is, at times you do not commit the error, or you are not the one that would be found to have misconducted yourself, but you know, the entire system that you'd be put in might actually put you in a situation where, without knowingly so, or without having those intentions, you'd find yourself just being eliminated through this process. That's my submission.
Don't talk about women in labor, please. Come on. Williams.
Thanks, Chairperson. I just want to say that I think that the law shouldn't just respond to situations that are happening now. And using examples about what's happening now is very reactionary. And perhaps you should look at the principle of this and not what's happening now. Because this sounds like this has been put in now to deal with what we're currently dealing with. But this law could sit here for the next 50 years, and you know what I'm saying. So I think in your argument you shouldn't be reactionary. I want to know why, on principle, this is undermining the security of employment, regardless of the level of the employees' pay. For instance, what's to stop the minister in 10 years' time dropping the level? And it won't be only covering DGs or people earning R1 million, like you say to us today. What's to stop that figure going from R1 million to R300,000 in 10 years' time or so. There's nothing in here to do that. So fundamentally what can happen is, it all sounds nice now, and you can get rid of the people that you're currently trying to get rid of that you can't get rid of under our current legislation. But in 10 years' time, you might want to be trying to get rid of people earning much less money and using this as a reason. And therefore, principles, this is not a principled piece of legislation. It's also quite dodgy because it removes fundamental rights. So I just want to know what exactly is this? Is this, are we going to every 5 years change legislation to deal with the lack of implementation or interpretation of the law? Thank you.
Honorable Member.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, the question and maybe some comments.
The question is the consultation in relation to the determination of the threshold. As to what extent will that happen, and I think that's important. And secondly, obviously, if you say million rand today may be different tomorrow, it may either be 2 million rand, or it may either be 300,000 actually. My issue is, I think we'll have to look at the changed relationship of employment at the higher level. And maybe we should ask ourselves also as to why are certain employees not allowed to join a union? You know, if you put differently, I'm worried, and I share sentiment that says, to what extent will this law have an impact on the prejudice particular employees at a certain level on the one hand, and what sort of recourse would they have, and whether is this about a unilateral implementation of this section, say when it comes to the DG. The minister unilaterally says that, look, let's terminate your contract, will give you 3 months notice, etc., etc., etc. So on the one hand, I'm quite concerned about the kind of recourse, because I think you've made mention of not taking away any other recourse that is available other than the recourse which is within the Labour Relations Act. So I think a fair explanation on that is going to be very, very important. But on the other hand, it's that question I raised earlier as to, we should also be asking ourselves the question why a certain category of employees are not allowed to join a trade union or actually forsake certain rights as accorded in the Labour Relations Act already, given their position and authority. You don't expect a DG to be a shop steward of now, for instance. You expect him to take responsibility of the department, and listen to what the House of Stewards would say. Otherwise, if you left such a situation, then there will be chaos. So I think that if we are however this discussion ends, it must be beyond how much a person can, but must also include the authority responsibility of that person. I don't know how you'll express that in law, in legislation, because a person can earn less than a DG, but they may still have much more authority in a company, than a DG may have, for instance. But, and as I said earlier about looking into the changing employment relationship, the people at senior level, your CEOs of companies and all of that, the benefits are beyond, the wages which they get, and that they may also, it may also include part ownership of the company. So your senior management in the private sector, or well, maybe even in the public sector, and the way in which they are being treated by the people who employ them, by the firms or companies which employ them, is completely different from, 10, 15 years ago. And in fact, there's a rise of what is called you know, your, well, a section that is much higher than your traditional middle class, which occupies senior management, which has part ownership in companies, which is highly paid, which has much more recourse than any other ordinary worker. So I think that we need to take that into consideration. So it is for me a balance between the two things, that there will still be recourse outside of the Labor Relations Act, firstly, and secondly, that we'll have to take into consideration all of the things that has changed in terms of the employment relationship.
Chairperson, can I just briefly come in again on this issue? I'm intrigued by what Mr. Mukhalipi has said, you know, to say if the minister can't work with the DG must quietly walk away. Or in a board, the CEO has a problem, they must quietly walk away. How many instances where we have witnessed or we have heard that the reason this person is given a golden handshake is because there's irreparable relationships between the DG or between the board, the CEO and board. And the vagueness of the statement of irreparable relations between the board and the CEO or the CEO and the CFO can be open up for any interpretation, or any person, I for one would argue and say there are times when people purge each other just to get this person away from the scene. And if we are going to allow our laws to be opened up to such, we'd find ourselves in trouble, because I'd come in as a minister, because I mean, I am a potential minister, you know, come in, just do not have relations with the DG, and then come in and fight irreparable differences or relations with the DG and apply the law. Or, you know, there's bad blood between people. You know, at times a person walks in or a person is appointed, there's automatically bad blood. People can't just stand each other. Whether the person has done anything or has not done anything, there's just that. And no matter how hard the poor CFO or CEO or DG tries to come and be a person to this human being, they'll never get it right. How are we going to, you know, in Swati, we always, there's a saying that says, you know, there's this sour, I don't know what others call it, but MRC is just sour. And if, let's say, something gets in there, how are you going to separate that from the rest? That's just, you know, it's not me having a position, because I clearly don't want to sound like I already have a position on this, but I just want, you know, us not to just do things for the sake of doing them. At the end of the day, the very same legislation would prejudice the poor person that has found himself earning 1 point something million, and they just have a bad blood between the board and themselves, and this very same law can be used against them. I'm just strongly opposing the quietly walking away. You know, that one says a lot of things can happen.
Quietly walking away for a labor gang, a wildcat running away, and a domestic cat work cat, you know, you're walking slowly. The house pet. Yeah, Jose, let's hear from you.
Chief, it's a matter of head you lose, tail you lose. I'm making these examples in order to try and explain to members real examples. I mean, if I'm going to make examples of something that are not real, so I try and explain the law. That's what the examples are for. It's real examples that I'm making that the law would be able to. But that's not meaning that the law is drafted to deal with this particular case. When I explain the legislation, this is my responsibility here. The chair said, speak English. explain for us so that we can understand. And now I'm using examples that everybody else should understand. And that's the intention of example, nothing else. That's the first thing. The second thing, this is an international recognized principle. It's an international recognized principle that there will be people that the ambit of protection will be above, that is beyond them. It's an expected international principle. The issue is, how far should you go? That's the difference between countries, how far should you go? But the issue of exclusion of certain categories of workers in law is an acceptable principle. It goes with the issue of constitutionality. We believe this will pass the test of constitutionality. We believe that. Remember, if you read this provision, it says, I want to read it. The minister must, in consultation with NEDLAC and by noticing the Government Gazette, make a determination of the amount referred to in subsection 1 and must take into account, this is very important, must take into account the extent to which employees, by reason of their earning level of skills, position, have sufficient bargaining power, to ensure that adequate provision may be made by their contract. This is what it says. It says, these employees that we're talking about, when the minister of achievement, the level, looking at the skills of people that we talk about, the level of pay, everything, it's people who got enough power to negotiate their own contract. Now, if their contract says that in disputes here, if there's any dispute between me and the board, I'll accept 12 months pay. That's what the contract says. This law doesn't change that. It says those people have got enough power. They are mobile. You talk about people who are mobile here. You're not talking about the sweeper who dismissed, who will take another year to get a job. Talk about mobile people who just don't go in an organization and work. They go on their terms because they agree on the terms. The contract will say this. If the contract says that, that contract applies in terms of this session. That's the first thing. I'll read it again. It says, have sufficient bargaining power to ensure that adequate provisions may be made in their contract. Because bargaining power to ensure that those people that we're talking about anticipate and say, what happens when the contract ends? In the contract. If they've got shares in this company, it will be there in that contract and it will indicate, when I'm dismissed, what happens to the shares. This provision respects that. This provision. That's what the law says. It says the reason we want to exclude them is because they've got power to negotiate in their contract their own provisions. And those provisions are respected by the law. Remember the law, nothing the law respects like a contract between two parties. The law does not want to interfere with contracts between two parties. When two parties enter into a contract, the law interferes only on exceptional cases. In this case that we're talking about, it's people who are vulnerable. If they enter into a contract, the contract is contrary to the law, it's unfair, the law interferes. In this case, the law can't interfere if there's a contract. This is what the law says. Because these people are capable of negotiating their own contract in terms of how to deal with disputes. That's what the first thing is there. Therefore, if you are a chief executive officer, you've got a contract, it does not spell out these issues. You are not worth to be CFO in the first place. If you are a DG, you've got a contract, it does not spell out how to deal with those issues. You should not be a DG in the first place. Secondly, remember this. This is not about anything. This is about protecting organizations. This proposal is protecting organizations. Remember I said, when there's a fight between the minister and the DG, service delivery suffers. Nobody can argue against that. If there's a fight between the minister and the DG, arrest short in that department, it will be the last of service delivery. 7th Divari Sabha. And we're saying, therefore, when there's a fight at the door, the grass gets damaged. And we're saying, you should not destroy organizations because the CFO, the CEO, and the board can't see eye to eye. And that put at risk the jobs of the worker that you want to protect. If you want to protect the job of the worker, you must make sure that the stability at the top, that protects the job of the workers. If there's no stability at the top, it puts the job of workers at risk. That's what the principle of this proposal that's what that we're putting on the table. The second issue, I've indicated that the National Development Plan says 300,000. That's what they say. It's them who says anybody earning more than 300,000 should not have access to the CCMA. That's what the plan is saying. Anybody earning that amount should not have access to the CCMA. They should be regarded as high earners who deal with their dispute differently, not in the CCMA. Nowhere in this proposal do we say that. Now, let's come back to the issue of gender. We can't hide behind gender on the issue of misconduct. I mean, because we're talking misconduct here. If a female DG fights with a minister, for whatever reason, the consequences are the same for service delivery. Whether it's male or female, the consequences are the same. That's where we're coming from. Therefore, for us in terms of the law, we treat that the same. But remember, this section says, I'll read it again, it says, despite section 1811, despite the first section, the dismissal of an employee to whom this section applies is, if it is not automatically unfair. Now, if your dismissal is automatically unfair, this does not apply. If you are dismissed because you are female, if you are dismissed because you are black, if you are dismissed for whatever reason that you are discriminated, is on the basis of discrimination, this does not apply. This restriction does not apply. You can take up your case just like any other case that is in law. That's what this says. Therefore, if the board dismisses a female CEO, and that dismissal hinges on discrimination for whatever reason, that CEO can fight their case just like any other case in terms of this action. This is not about security of employment. In this action, remember, we're talking about people here who are portable. They don't have fear about security of employment, the people that we're talking about. Yes, at the lower level, if this threshold that we're talking about was 300,000 as the MTC proposed, this issue would have been a problem. But at the level that we're talking about, we don't think that it does anything about security. In fact, if it takes fights at the board level, it secures employment for those at the bottom. A company that is stable is more likely to succeed than an unstable company. I'm not saying that that's always the case, but the chances of a company that is stable at the top succeeding than a company that is not stable at the top are far greater, the chances. Therefore, we believe that this proposal increases the prospect for job security for all workers because it deals with how to deal with disputes effectively at the top. The issue of what is it to stop the minister tomorrow? What happens when you get a bad minister? Because when you make law for the worst times. You don't make law for the good times. You make law for the worst times. Well, if the minister that comes into place for whatever reason does not consult, as the law says, if we get that minister, then it's not going to be about this section. If we have that minister, it's not going to be about reflection. It's going to be about all the rights that workers have. If we've got such a minister, that minister will come in, this piece of paper, and amend this regulation and take all the rights. It's not about this section. If you've got a government that says, we're not interested in protecting workers, they're not going to look. This section, this is a list of their worries. The section that they will go going on, they'll go to DCA, they go to the whole of the LRA. Then we can't legislate for that. That is an issue about elections. That is an issue about government. It's not a legal issue. It's not a legal issue. In terms of the law as it is now, the NEDLAC Act says all labor legislation must be consulted at NEDLAC. This Act says the minister must consult at NEDLAC before introducing any regulation. It means that the minister will go, when this is passed, go to NEDLAC and say, I intend to make a regulation in terms of this section. And this is the amount that I want to put. These are the reasons I want to put that amount. These are the number of people that we think it will affect. And the whole information put in front of the parties at NEDLAC. And rest assured, if any of the parties at NEDLAC are not happy with that, you will know about it. One way or the other, you will know about it. And that's the security that parties have on this, that it must be consulted at NEDLAC. Therefore, we don't think that the change of ministry, if the ministry change course altogether, this is the area that we should be worried about. For us, we'd be more worried about the other protections that are in the law that are protecting vulnerable workers. A consultation network means giving all the information. It doesn't mean agreement, admitting, but it means genuine consultation. And the Department of Labor has got a history of consulting genuinely at NEDLAC, giving all the information. We might disagree on many things, we might disagree, but the department can never be forced about its consultation process. In all the ministers that we've had, starting with Tito, going to Belzana, and to the present minister, her history, what the one department that has never have a single complaint at NEDLAC about its refusal to consult. We submit even things that we're not supposed to submit at NEDLAC for consultation because we believe it is the right thing. And we don't think that any minister, unless we change the law, will do that. Now, when I said that 1 million now, the power of 1 million today is not the same as the power of 1 million. It didn't mean that the minister would change the 1 million. Obviously, for the 1 million, the minister next year said the threshold is 1,500,000. The minister must make sure that 1,500,000 remains 1,500,000 even in 5 years' time. The power of that should be the same. That's where inflation comes in. The minister must regularly upgrade. The minister can't say 1,500,000 and then the next year say it's 1 million. Two different things if you reduce it. When you put in an increase on inflation, you're making sure that that 1 million is worth the same 1 million that it was worth when the regulation comes in. That's what I intended when I made that example. The issue, what are the recourse for high earners? It's the same issue that I've raised. The recourse is their contract. They can, in their contract, have provisions that deals with how to deal with disputes. Their disputes, and the law allows that. That's their recourse. If they don't do that, it's their problem. Union membership, well, there are two differences here in terms of union membership. The law, the LRA says, trade union must be independent of employers. Employers must be independent of trade unions. The International Labour Organization convention accepts and go the same way. Now, there's no law that prevents senior managers to become union members. But if the DG is a shop steward of the clerks in the DG, one can successfully argue that that contravene the principle of independence of the two parties, because the law says a trade union must be independent of the employer, and the organization must also be independent. And there was a case, unfortunately it did not go in court, there was a case about this area where a foul shop steward was offered a job as at a different level, and the company said, well, we're offering you this job on condition that you cease to be shop steward, because now you are part of management. And there was a case, a big case that goes on this issue. But and we were also asked to comment precisely on this issue, because it goes into the heart of the separation of powers, if you use that term, separation of powers between management. Not saying that they should not be union members, but can a CEO of an organization be a shop steward of the workers that are sweepers, for example, who are reporting there? And there is an argument that that would be contrary to our legislation in terms of independence. That would be contrary to the ILO convention in terms of the independence of the two parties, for the trade union must be independent of the lawyer. But if there is a trade union that represents that area of management, the law allows that. And therefore, those are the contradictions that the law already has foreseen in terms of this area. I think you have dealt with all the questions. I'm not sure to see whether you want to add. Oh.
Just one thing.
Yes, Mr. Lucas.
Okay, thank you very much, Honourable Chair. I have no doubt in my mind that the majority of honourable members sitting in this room have at one point or the other heard of cases that are delayed at the CCMA level, at the labor court level, where workers wait endlessly to get their cases finalized. You may have also heard that one of the reasons why some of the cases take this long, other than the fact that we don't have enough judges in our labor court, given its less attractive nature, it is that the system is clogged by people who end pretty well, who are not vulnerable, so to speak. They clog the system. And primarily, CCMA was set up for vulnerable workers. That's why workers don't pay when they go to CCMA. It's completely subsidized by government. Now, do we also want to create an environment where we even subsidize people who are not vulnerable and to go through the system and end up occupying the space that ordinarily is the space created for vulnerable workers? So in part, this instrument is meant to give a bias, a real bias to vulnerable workers, given the fact that the people who are in the higher echelons, in the wage and salary brackets, those are the people that have a reasonable high level of bargaining power. So for that reason, it's unclogging the system. It's unclogging the system and ensuring that the system serves those for whom it was intended, as opposed to the system being clogged by people who are high earners, because they do have alternatives that could deliver the same, if not better, protection than CCMA and these provisions. They could achieve the very same thing using different instruments altogether. So it's for that reason, and it's informed by the philosophy that government has taken when it comes to LRA, and the philosophy is protection of vulnerable workers. Whatever the philosophy might be, that someone who earns a million and more is considered vulnerable, at the moment it's a policy matter. What we are proposing is an instrument to give back to that policy matter. And the policy is those earning about the threshold that a minister will consult and set from time to time should not enjoy the same benefits in terms of the law as the vulnerable workers. So this is an instrument that seeks to give effect to that policy that there has to be that. Discrimination, yes, there are instances where progressive discrimination is allowed.
And I think in this case it falls in that category. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. No, thank you. I'm done. Thank you very much.
Honorable Manamela, I know under hand. Okay, by the key.
Thank you, many other four setters.
I need an interpreter.
Look, my point is that as much as $1 today is equal to 8 rands, $1 tomorrow can be equal to 5 rands. That's the point I was trying to illustrate, that the power of a million rands, or the value of a million rand, its real value in the future may be lower or higher. So it's not that the determination may actually change. But my other, well, I'm quite happy with the explanation that there is recourse in instances where employees believe that their rights as per the contract of employment may have actually been violated, and that they can actually pursue these matters through different channels. Then the third point, which I think we'll still have to look into, is that, and which I think should at all times underpin our discussions in the amendments process, is that the employment relationships have significantly changed. From the traditional employment relations, where you have a clear employer on the one side and a clear employee on the other side. And some of the laws which we're obviously proposing are going to be debating for some time. We're still on the easy part, we're flowing nicely on the easy part. But all of those things are a reflection of the fact that the employment relationship has changed. And people that we may regard as employees, your DGs, your CEOs, are people who take responsibility, on behalf of the employer, even if they may be classified as employees. And I think when we debate particularly this, when we vote or when it comes down to the actual wording, we have to take into consideration that fact, that there are people who may be regarded as employees, but who take responsibility on behalf of the employer, and by definition, by role, by authority, may or should actually not be regarded as your ordinary, employees. As and when, and with the best wishes of the president, Comrade Shelley becomes a minister. I think you should become the DG, because I think you are much safer. Hopefully she will not remember this discussion and ask you too quietly.
Okay.
Let us listen now in progress. Dr. Lewis.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you, members. But also not a constitutional court judge. that's quite a scary source to ask to think as a constitutional, or to predetermine what a constitutional court judge would find. Maybe just as an initial point, honourable members raised concerns with regard to discrimination and especially also gender in the deliberations or the discussions. We had also just a discussion, but my sister pointed out is in the section or sub 2, it says despite section 108.81, the dismissal of an employee to whom the section applies is if it is not automatically unfair as contemplated in section 1.871. And then if members look at the Principal Act, in there it says in that sub F that employer unfairly discriminated against an employee directly or indirectly on any arbitrary grounds, including but not limited to race, gender, sex, racial origin, and the list that on and on and on. So your discrimination categories are covered. Nobody can within this clause be discriminated against unfairly or based on an arbitrary decision. just the outset. With regard to the rest of the section's phrasing, we took note of the members of honourable members' concerns, and also from our colleagues from the department stating that there is a right-centred approach at the bottom of this. Its intention is not to take constitutional rights blindly away. We would like to add constitutional court judges do to reserve judgment and report back in a reasonable time. No. Just to consult with the full bench at our offices as well. With the committee's permission, Chair.
The last time lawyers said that was about 8 years ago, and we're still waiting for that reasonable time. I hope it's going to be within the within our the lifetime of this committee. Thank you. Let me give Honourable Masrumula. What were the other hands before I give over to? Okay, then I'll have Honourable Van der Westhuizen. And would you want to make a follow-up on what she said, or should we take new questions? A follow-up, yes, you're welcome, Ms. Williams.
Thank you. Also just to point out that this decision by the Minister cannot be arbitrary. All the concerns is in fact taken care of in Subsection 4. Subsection 4 provides, as the Department has pointed out, the Minister must, in consultation with NEDLAC, and as we know, NEDLAC is business, employees, trade unions, it's the whole cluster together. So the Minister can't take it on its own. It must take. So all those concerns, all those nuances, irrespective of who the next Minister may be, irrespective of what the thinking of the next Minister may be, they can't act on their own. They have to act in consultation. So in consultation, even a bigger, it gives the Minister less discretion. Because it's not often, so everybody must agree to this before it can go ahead, and not only the minister. So in fact, it takes away the minister's discretion, but puts in place a consultative process. So I think that must answer the questions with regard to everything. Thanks.
Thank you, Baya. Honourable Masrumula.
Thank you, sir. I tried to listen. Mine is a dream. I think nature does allow people to dream.
Yes.
I'm just trying to find out from Mkhalidi and everybody present. Can we find a different definition of highness? Because I'm looking at the explanation or definition of owners of means of production. If a directing manager have shares in the company, automatically becomes part of the owners of means of production. How do you categorize this worker? You see a worker. Why do you? Can we find something from high earners employee? High earners. What does it mean? To me, I mean, where I am now. If this person is part of owners of the means of production, why do you call him a high earner? Because he's part of the owners of the means of production, automatically. He seems to become a worker, ordinary worker. How do you do? I'm just dreaming. I think it's fair to dream.
That's capital.
Logan, are you taking us back to the Labour Bureau of Value? Don't make us lament the past. But the past is living in the present anyway. Khalif, you are the only person who understands English.
The answer difficult one. Really difficult to ask. Really, it's a difficult one.
I think
you see, high earners make it easy for everybody.
to differentiate. I mean, differentiation on the basis whether you own the means of production. You've got to read the hospital. It's a longer process. It's a very difficult one.
If it's a dream, that's us, Comrade Matrumule, to wake up. I think that will solve the problem. But I think, Comrade, there is an argument on this one. But I think it depends on how you explain it, because there is something called corruption. And we talk about class suicide, you know. Once you move from being a worker, from the working class family, with a working class background, through your education, and with other people with a little bit of luck, you end up ascending to a higher level where you are trusted by the owners of the means of production as the person who can look after their interests, even if they are not there. So, you know, so you actually graduate from being a worker, you transcend your class and become part of the bourgeoisie and defend their interest with everything, you know, in your power, your life included, you know. So it does happen, Comrade Masrumule, that people can ascend, or it's not easy to descend class. No, it is actually very possible nowadays. With the crisis that the social system is going through, people fall from grace, from staying in Santilu, go and live with us in Tembisa, go in Mandela, you know, and the only people who will suffer, you will understand who you are there. People who will suffer will be your children. They will always talk about their past. They'll never talk about their present, and that is the only crisis that they will suffer. But I think this is a much more involved discussion, you know, and thanks for making us think about it. Where are we now? There are some other comments and questions that were asked by the other members. We've answered all of them. Are they... No, but I think we should give this one to, if Mr. Mfid is to ask for my advice, I think when you grow up, you should become a teacher. Okay. Yeah, when you get big, become a teacher, and I think I'll be a student in school. We actually stopped with this. Before we close, we need to look at some thing tomorrow, the program tomorrow. Yeah. The BRRR, that we start with that in the morning, and then after that, if there's still time, then we'll go into legislation. Our partners here from the department, you are welcome to come and attend the meeting in the morning, if you may. And then after that, we'll go into the legislation, I think, immediately after that. I'll say that maybe the BRRR will take us an hour. Or, or more, it definitely cannot be less than an hour. Yeah, no, I think it will be given the, yeah, we'll see what it does. I think something will be given to the moment. What I was talking to, I'm looking at the program for tomorrow, as you can see on the agenda. So I'll need to advise. Michelle.
Chairperson, talking to the program, or talking to tomorrow's program, I want to make a submission that I've made to the secretary in the form of writing and copied yourself, that I would come late to the meeting because I have a doctor's appointment. That's for your consideration tomorrow in the meeting.
That is in order. And then there's a member who doesn't, his church doesn't allow him to attend meetings on Wednesday. The apology is denied. yes, on that note, let's meet again tomorrow.
Chief, can I just confirm that we have two Bush lawyers here?
They just get, it's labor and it's still the same thing. Still amendment. They just gave me the...
Is this not a bill, this one?
Yeah, the labor relations amendment though. The one that you gave me when I did the meeting, the last two meetings I did.
Yes, I understand, but they didn't give you any amendments, like...
No.
No.
Literally, this is just the first take that was the same thing. So should I just put that page?
We don't put the what do you call the one in parliament, the what do you call the member. It's only the outsiders, no?
Yeah.
The suburban group parliament.
Also, you don't put them.
Like you know, like the members that are there as parliament.
Yeah.
You know those on that list. Okay. The only one we put is only the others one. Yes.
Is Rashad sitting here today?
Mm-hmm.
I'm Rashad again.
Yeah, Rashad.
I'm
Where is it?